Welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Matt Oper and Chris Baines. How's it going, Chris?
UC is officially in the off season. It could be a little better, to be honest. How you doing, Matt?
No bueno.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I didn't really expect them to come out of, like, the Iowa game and beat Tennessee, but just the emphatic thud that the season came to at the end of that Iowa game was just, I don't know. It hurts every year. I feel like just based on preseason expectations, you know, maybe it should have hurt a little less this year, but it didn't. It didn't hurt less.
After the game, like, if anybody followed me on Twitter, it was just, like, such a douche thing to say. I really wasn't, like, too upset, like, at the game itself. Like, I thought the team played really hard, and, like, they had, like, chances to tie the game down the stretch. Like, they get, like, Broom had a wide-open three he missed. Like, Jennifer completely wide open. Like, and he has one rim out. They had, like, ran a really great play to get Cumberland an open look, except like the pass was really high. Like, the game wise, it was like frustrating, but like I was okay with how the guys played themselves and how hard they tried. Like, everything around, like, the program has really gotten under my skin the last couple of days, but we can save that for later. What were your snap thoughts, Matt?
Another defensive meltdown in the tournament. Like, for all Nick's reputation as a defensive guru who manages to get his team into the top, usually top 10, but this year was top 40 in terms of adjusted defensive efficiency. Every year they get to the tournament and play good offenses that are well coached, and they just get shredded. This is not a one-off. This has happened multiple years in a row. It's if you're going to build your program on defense and make defensive toughness the hallmark of everything you do, you actually have to do it in the tournament, and they haven't done it. I mean, that's the most frustrating part about it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is Iowa shot 50% from three. It was the seventh time this year an opponent had shot 45% from three or more. I mean, this is a team whose weakness defensively was the three-point line, and it's something we've known all season, and we talked about this before the podcast. It's something Nick's got to know, being the, quote, defensive guru, like you mentioned. And it was, yet again, an NCAA tournament team torching this team defensively. A lot of fans use this game to fall back on the old complaints of Mick doesn't know how to coach offense. He needs to hire an offensive coordinator, whatever the hell that means, get more offensive scores, whatever. But the reasons UC lost this year was because they allowed opponents to shoot lights out from beyond the three-point line. They allowed them to cut inside a lot without any opposition, and it's the way they've been bounced out of the NCAA tournament year after year. I mean, you can argue that, yeah, you're facing Lonzo Ball a few years ago, and, you know, it's just a bad matchup. But if you want to be compared as a defensive program to, like, the likes of Virginia, like Tony Bennett, like, watch, like, what Virginia did. I mean, they had troubles against, I think it was Gardner Webb in the beginning of, in the first game, but they completely shut down Oklahoma outside of the first, like, 5 or 10 minutes. Like, we haven't seen that out of UC in the last 5 years of making the tournament. Like, if you're going to be a defensive-minded coach and that's what you're going to focus on, you know, forget whatever scoring you're going to do. I mean, if you're allowing opponents to shoot 50% from three for you in tournament play, you're never going to get that done.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're just not going to get it done, period. And the three-point defense was a gigantic bugaboo, as you guys mentioned, all season long. Like, from game one against Ohio State, when, like, that team bombed threes on them, to every single conference game. Like, the only team in the conference that gave up like worst three-point shooting was East Carolina, and East Carolina was very bad. Like, that was just part of the defense that they decided to go with this season, and it got exploited big time. Like, I know, like, the, some teams, like, scheme for you to take threes, but it's, like, the threes that they gave up in the defense were, like, the threes that other teams hunt. I don't know, it was, like, really kind of odd to see, like, a team that had, like, such a big defensive reputation just give up corner threes or threes at the top of the key. Like, and not the threes that, like, take Virginia or, like, even, like any team that plays, like, the pack line defense. Like, they make you take those threes off the wing and take, like, the tough threes. Or do what Central Florida did against Duke and just make their guys who can't shoot take all the threes. Except it was, for UC, it was, like, every superstar player got, like, a ton of looks from three. Like, they gave up, like, Weiskamp. Just, like, wide open threes every single time. Like, Bahanda got, like, a number of good looks. He didn't have, a great game three-point-wise. But then, like, he was able to use his shot fake to get in the lane. Like, it was something that was a problem all season long. And, like, they were able to, like, skate through, like, some of the AAC teams that just, like, weren't great. But then, like, once it really mattered, they couldn't get a stop, as you said, Chris. They couldn't get, like, any stops in the second half of the game. And even, like, that late run in the first half, like, you have an 11-point lead at the 4-minute break. It's down to 5, and then the game is on the second half.
And I feel like that was one of kind of the frustrating aspects of the game as we watched this team evolve over the last couple of weeks. They come out of that Houston game, and Corey Davis just lights them up. And UC responds to that in the AAC title game by focusing on Houston's sharpshooters, the ones that beat them the week before. They took them out of the game and they played that, like you mentioned, that game of, you know, letting the scorers that, or letting the 3-point shooters that don't shoot well from three beat you. And if they beat you, fine. But then they come into the Iowa game and allow Joe Weiskamp, who shoots 42% from three, to shoot six threes. He made four of them, of course, because he's a good 3-point shooter. It's like whatever lessons they learned from the Houston game, they never adapted to this Iowa game, who, you know, they play a little bit different defense, but they're still a very prolific offense like Houston was. You'd think they would have taken those lessons and applied it to this game, but they just never did.
Yeah, and like this is the issues with defending the 3-point line is not germane to just this season. Like, this has been an issue with the Bearcats going back multiple years since Mick Cronin switched to this kind of amoeba matchup zone defense. Like, quarter threes have been a problem for years. You were able to mask it a little bit better when you had Gary Clark and Jacob Evans prowling the wing and kind of erasing mistakes. But as soon as you take those two pieces out of the equation, like that was a glaring problem all year long. But it's been a problem for years. Like, good teams, smart teams, well-coached teams hunt those looks because they know they're going to be able to get them against this defense just because they overhelp and they overswitch on everything, even stuff where you don't even need to do it. And it's a recurring problem. And, like, but it's not acknowledged as such, which is a little bit frustrating because, you know, post-game comments are always something of the same variety. We just need to defend better. But he never talks about how this scheme doesn't really suit the players he has. And he has to know that. Because if we can see that, how can he not?
Like, the last 4 years, just on KenPom, like, 3-point defense for the opponents, UC was 235 in 2016. Their opponents hit 35.7%. 2017, it was 34.1%, which ranked 134. Like, last year was amazing. They were, like, opponents were under 30%. And the conference play was just, like, lights out when, like, the conference couldn't shoot. And, like, this year, it's 239 nationally at 35.5%. And your conference opponents shoot 37% from three. So, like, yeah, it's, like, been a rolling problem where teams have really figured out their defense. Like you said, and, like, when you don't have, like, a bunch of seniors and, like, a bunch of guys who are really dedicated to the defensive side of the ball, like, it really shows. And even then, like, as we saw last year, and, like, almost every single game they lost, Like, it really showed, like, when you can't get stops. Because like, then it ties hand-in-hand with the offense, which, like, was good against Iowa, but it still had a lot of the same issues that his teams have, and that's you don't have any shooters, and they take away the main part of your offense, and you don't score a basket for, well, like, 3 minutes, 4 minutes near the end of the game. Like, those stretches are killer. Like, you can't take those against any good teams. And
well, yeah, and
go ahead.
You know, like, every loss is unique, and every NCAA tournament loss is unique, but when it comes to this program under Mick, they might be different, but they all rhyme. Like, there is a five-minute drought in the last 10 minutes of the game where they cannot buy a bucket when one or two buckets would stem the tide and allow them to kind of coast out a victory. Like, that moment happens in every game they lose, and they can never get that bucket because the offense is just too stagnant. Like, and the offense was fine this year. It was top 40, whatever. But, like, Mick constantly talks about, and like, we're going to kind of shift into a broader topic of the program at large at this point, because unless either of you have stuff to say about Iowa still.
I mean, I could go into the fact that Cumberland was completely silent for most of the second half. They struggled to break the press. They got a 10-second violation. They settled for jump shots and break past breaks. But I feel like that's too micro right now. I'm fine moving on.
Yeah, so, like, Mick constantly talks about how he wants to win a national championship here. Well, this is what it's going to take. In the KenPom era, right, so that's going back to 2002, every single national title winner has a top 20 offense and a top 20 defense. The top 20 defense is, like, they can hit that mark. They usually hit that mark. This year they didn't because it was a slightly worse team, but whatever. They were still top, what, 28th, I think, is where they ended up ranking. But, like, they never come close on offense because they don't really run offense. Like, they have the same three sets they've been running for years, and everybody knows it and can predict it and knows how to stop it. And it's just becomes a slog when you get to this level where every decision is magnified and you are so well scouted by these teams. Like, there's no adjustment. It's like, if plan A doesn't work, there is no plan B. And that's why they keep faltering on this stage.
That, I think that's a really fair point. Like, I think you could even be more snarky and make the comment they have two offenses. Like, one is the regular offense they run, and one is the superstar offense when they have a superstar player who takes the ball off the floor and makes like every decision to get the offense going. And as like Chris mentioned, like with Cumberland, like Iowa focused on him, and like he's not gonna beat us, and he didn't really have a great game against Iowa. Like, he ended up making some shots down the stretch. But, like, if he's not taking every single shot, like, making every single assist, like he had to do against Iowa, like, your team is sunk. You have no other playmakers. Which I think is one of the other biggest things that ties in is, besides, like, Cashmere Wright, have they had, like, an above-average point guard? Like, an actual point guard? I don't really think they have. Like, Troy Copain was good. Like, he was, I don't know, he might have been above average, but I don't think he was, like, an amazing point guard.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was, I think what you're, Scott, if, not to put words in your mouth, you're looking for, like, a scoring point guard, right? Like, someone who can take, you know, take the ball up the court and, I don't know, line up a three-point shot without even passing the ball. Like, I feel like that was Cash Wright, but, like, Troy and Justin Jennifer, they're all pass-first point guards, right?
Yeah, that's like kind of what I meant. Like, it's just something like where you can like have somebody else make something happen, like on your team, like where you don't have just one guy to focus on. Like, even like Copain, it's like other teams like started focusing on him, and his scoring was never really consistent, despite how good of a passer he could be at times.
Yeah, and like Jerron's most effective spot is, and we talked about it last week, is when he gets the ball on the, like in that free throw area at the nail, and he gets to work from there. But teams are so good at denying him the ball from that spot, where it's kind of like in soccer, where if you have a really creative, like Lionel Messi is a perfect example. Like, he is a forward, but if he can't get the ball in his forward positions, he will drop all the way back to the midfield and just take the ball and do everything himself. And that's what Duran had to do in this Iowa game. By the end of the game, like, he was bringing the ball up every possession because that's the only way he knew he was going to be able to control what was going to happen on offense, because they just couldn't enter the ball to him.
And, like, we saw with the last, like, couple of years where, like, Jacob Evans is, like, your default point guard. Then, like, going back, like, Kilpatrick is your point guard. Like, you don't really have any of, like, the on-ball guys that seem to really trust outside of Copain. And even then, like, with the teams with Copain, they had Evans. And then, like, no other real consistent other scorers on those teams. Despite how, like, good everybody else was. Like, that was what, like, Gary Clark's one big, like, mark against him was, like, he was never a selfish scorer. And, like, who knows, like, maybe those teams would have been a little better if he was more often, since he was, like, by far, like, their best player.
They definitely would have been better if he was more assertive on offense. There's no doubt about that. He's just not that guy. Because, and like, that's, Mick, generally, Mick doesn't pick that guy. That guy who is an alpha dog, who wants the ball, who talks shit all the time, like, that is so not a Mick player. Like, he stays away from those guys like they have the plague. But you need a little bit of that in your team. You really do. For moments like when the other team is on a middle of a run and you still have the lead, but you need to stem the tide. You need a guy who's just going to be like, you know what, fuck them. I'm taking the ball. I got this. We're good. And that guy is not a character that has been... Yeah, you know, that kind of character has not been in a McCronin team since, what, Lance? And that was almost 10 years ago? Exactly 10 years ago.
And that seemed to be, like, Lance was available in, like, August.
Yeah, everybody kicked the tires on Lance, and nobody actually pulled the trigger. And then Mick's like, all right, I guess I'll try it. He tried it. He didn't like it. He's not tried it again.
I mean, I would say... To a degree, they haven't had alpha dogs for a couple of years, but I think the philosophy is changing over the last maybe since like 2017 or so. Like, Cumberland is an alpha dog type player. Like, we've seen this season where he can just take over games, but like, to your guys' point, he's been too inconsistent the last few months to be relied upon. Bringing in a guy like Samari Curtis He, like, set records at Xenia, and he's, like, was Mr. Ohio this year. That's another type of player who's kind of like an alpha dog. I think he's done a nice job of that in terms of the guard play. My biggest issue with the recruiting standpoint is that he's constantly recruiting projects, and I don't want to call them soft or whatever players, but, like, more developmental bigs. And, you know, we saw what, like, a Gary Clark type player. Like, you mentioned, Matt, you're spot on. Like, He's a talented player, but he doesn't have the type of attitude to take over games. Kyle Washington was a transfer into the program. Like, when was the last big that UC had that Mick recruited that you could say, yeah, that's a guy who I know is going to take over a game if he wants to? Like, Yancey Gates, maybe? Like, that's my biggest issue on the recruiting front.
That's the last one. Well, I mean, like, Mick loves a project. He thinks he can make an effective player out of anybody. And he's not proven correct on that in the last couple of years. Like, Trey Scott's a fine player, but at the beginning of the year, the role that Mick asked him to play as this kind of facilitator wing dude, like, he was so far out of his depth that this team didn't get good until Trey Scott started to do the things that he was actually good at. And, like, are any of the bigs on this roster going to be anywhere near as effective as even Kyle Washington, let alone Gary Clark? I can't see it. Yeah. I just can't see it.
Like, if you put like Trey Scott and Nysia Brooks together as a single player, I think you would approach them. I would about you could probably approach Gary Clark, but yeah, it's too few and far between, and that kind of goes back to our overarching theme of really, I don't know, this season, this podcast, like. your talent on this roster is very heavily in the corner of the guards and the wings. Like, why aren't you playing those four best players at all times and going with one power forward or a center? But I mean, that's something that's just never going to change, unfortunately.
Except, like, I don't know. See, this is something I've been thinking about, like, the last few days. Right? So, like, we say this all the time. But, like, then, like, you, like, rewind to, like, the only team that made the Sweet 16. Like, and, like, one of his most fun, like heart and soul teams was the Sweet 16 team for a number of reasons. But that team played the traditional way, like, until December 10th. When I don't know if you guys remember, but Cincinnati and Xavier got in a fight, and they had a lot of guys suspended.
Wait, what?
And then they didn't have two of their big guys for, like, the next, what, like, four games or whatever it was. And they played four guards and one big. And they did that the entire season. Like, so he's done that before. Like, not every guy they have is Jaquan Parker. And, like, not every guy they can, like, put in, like, the four spot is, like, Sean Kilpatrick. Like, but he's played four guards before. And, like, then the other big they mixed in was what they played, like, Justin Jackson and Cheick Mooj. And, like, those guys rotated in every once in a while. But, like, you played four guards and Yancey Gates, who could step out and shoot threes, like, every once in a while. Or at least step out for long twos. Like, that team was his most versatile team, and, like, it wasn't his best team. At least, like, not results-wise, and definitely not
statistically. No, results-wise, that is his best team, because what matters is March. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, like, true. Regular season titles are fine. They're great, whatever. But I don't give a fuck at this point. Like, they could win the next 10 regular season titles. If they fail in March every year, I will eventually want to mount Mick's head on a spike above the city of Cincinnati. Because, like, it's just so dumb. Like, the sport is passing you by. You are insisting that it's 1980 and that you have to have two bigs to succeed. Meanwhile, everyone else in the world is jacking up threes at an astonishing rate. And you just can't be bothered to get a shooter. More than one on the team. If you have more than one, that's too many shooters. You can't have that. It's just ridiculous.
My biggest issue is that when they did go small this year, they ran with, like, weird lineups. Like, if you're going to go small, put Jennifer Cumberland, Williams, and Broom as your 1-4, and then, I don't know, pick Scott or Brooks as a guy to anchor under the rim. But then when they would go small this year, they would throw out, like, Logan Johnson and Rashawn Fredericks. And it was almost just like a means of getting other guys rest rather than actually trying to generate any kind of, you know, new type of offense, you know, just to kind of switch things up, which is, like, it seems like so mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, because it is. It doesn't make any sense to be this dogmatic about your approach to a sport that is literally changing under your feet, but you just can't be bothered to see it.
Well, also the issue is that, like, how many good bigs are out there, like, in the recruiting world, right? Like, you mentioned, Scott, or Matt, that, like, the college game is going, you know, smaller and faster and more ball movement and whatever. Like, that's all stemmed from, like, high school. Like, how many good, like, bigs are out there that UC has a realistic shot at without throwing, you know, $100,000 at their parents or something like that? Like,
In the given class, if you get lucky, three or four?
Like, yeah, it's getting harder and harder to find talented big men. Like, the last time they were probably in on, like, a decent big man, I mean, I'm not even going to throw Jermaine Lawrence out there because he was a power forward that wanted to be, you know, James Harden. But, like, they were in on Nick Ward for a little while. He ended up going to Michigan State. But, like, every time UC's in on a big forward, it's almost like it's harder and harder for them to actually land a non-3-year developmental project from, like, Guam or whatever. Like, if that's the issue, if you're banging your head against the wall trying to get a power forward, make it easier on yourself and just go with the smaller lineup and go for the guards, which you've proven yourself to go out and be able to land talented guards.
And if, like, you look at it, like, that way, like, you put, like, more of, like, the, like, not, like, amazingly rated star players to to step up and, like, really grow in your program. Like, I believe, like, what Copain wasn't a 4-star, was he? I don't think he was. But, like, Jennifer was, like, a 3-star recruit. Like, Kevin Johnson was, like, a 3-star recruit. Like, those guys ended up turning out to be, like, decent. And I would say, like, they had better, like, numbers than, like, most of the bigs that have come through. So, like, yeah, I think that's a good point. And, like, if even, like, somebody like Logan Johnson, who looks like he has some kind of potential, is, like, a 3-star guard. And, like, you look at the bigs, and, like, they've been, like, mostly nice. But, like, that doesn't win you, like, a lot of games. And when you have to depend on them to be, like, your best players, almost.
Yeah, and, like, Nysir Brooks is kind of a perfect example of this. He became, shockingly, like, a really good, competent offensive player this year. But he has definite limits. Yeah. Like, his effective range is, like, if he's outside of 6 feet, he's not going to be an effective player on either end of the floor. He can't really play this switching scheme, even though Mick tried to, you know, they tried all year to make him kind of a switching big man, and he just can't do it. Like, he's not Clint Capella. He can't switch onto a guard and get him, you know, and actually cover them for an entire possession. But, like, that's what he ended up having to do because, I keep saying it, like, good teams would hunt him in defense all the time. They would get that guard switch because they knew he was either going to foul or get beat, and there was, like, no two ways about it. But, like, that's a success story. It is a guy who has a definite skill set but has huge limitations that can be easily exploited by good opposition. And like, if that's your success story, that's not good enough. So if you can't get enough big men to play this game that you want, and you can't because they're not enough of them in the world, like, frankly. Like, if you're 6'10 and can run and can jump and can play defense and can shoot, you're a one-and-done player, and you're not even looking at Cincinnati because Mick has a well-earned reputation for not putting up with those kind of guys. And
I think – sorry, go ahead, Matt.
No, it just shrinks your pool. By Mick being Mick, he is shrinking the pool of available candidates who can actually do what he needs done with big men.
And I think my biggest concern is that if you flash forward to next season, let's say Brooks and Scott should be better next year. They should be – I mean, they better be. They're going to be seniors. They're going to be starting pretty much every game. My concern is, like, after next season, you turn over the power forward spots to, like, Hardnett, Diarra, Gillum, and Sosame. And if we've seen anything about this team over the last 5 years, outside of, like, standouts like Gary Clark, it takes a while for a forward to, like, develop into the system. So all of a sudden, you turn over from Brooks and Scott to, like, a bunch of no-name guys, and you're going to see a huge drop-off in production. Whereas when you look at, like, a guy like Jaron Cumberland, I mean, he came in as a talented guard. He got good guard minutes as a freshman, and he put up 8 points per game, and then as a sophomore, 11 points per game. Like, the developmental curve is a lot less steep for bringing in guards than it is for forwards, apparently, in the system. So why wouldn't you focus on guards who can play early, and you wouldn't have that huge drop-off when you finally graduate those developmental forwards?
Well, it's not just that. It's like, why wouldn't you develop a scheme that will allow you to succeed with the kind of players that you can get?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest thing, right? Because to have success playing this way, you need to have elite, elite big men on both sides of the ball. Those guys are incredibly rare, and as the Adidas case has taught us, worth at least $100,000. And we don't have that kind of money sitting around, and we don't do that. There's never been a whiff of that around this program, and there never will be because Mick is very dogmatic about that, and I do appreciate that. But, like, this is a known restraint because you are not playing it on a fair playing field. It's tilted against you. So given that, These are systemic restraints that you're going to have and are always going to have for the foreseeable future unless something drastic happens in the next couple of years. And, like, getting rid of the one-and-done rule is going to change some of that, but, like, the money that Kentucky's paying people, it's just going to go to different players. It's not going to stop.
Well, the issue is that it's going to take the three or four bigs off market, and then it's basically going to mean that Kentucky's going to be going down to that, like, you know, top 20 to 40 pool, and that only – all that does is just basically shorten the pool as much as you are already.
Exactly. That makes it even more imperative to stop with this foolishness now, because it's not successful now. In 5 years when one-and-dones are allowed again, it's really not going to work.
And, like, I think you could, but, like, outside of Justin Jackson, you could make the case that, Gary Clark, obviously, like, most of the bigs that have come in here, like, actually, like, made, like, the impact that it seems like Mick has wanted were JUCOs. Like, Octavius Ellis was a JUCO. Like, DeBerry, like, for his offense, was a JUCO. Like, wasn't Mooj a JUCO?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's, like, three of, like, the big success stories. Like, they were all JUCOs until, like, the last few years where, like, Kyle Washington was a transfer. And, like, a lot of the homegrown guys, like, were just quadri more. And, like, it didn't pan out for one reason or another. Which I think is, like, a huge key. And, like, I think one of the biggest things about this team next year, it's, like, right now you have one recruit, like, every big coming back. And it's like if we don't see like the improvement off the bench guys, like Diarra and Sosame, like I think your ceiling is still like almost where it is now. And then you have to replace a ton of shooting next year, which is like almost like a bigger story for like an off-season podcast than a state of the program podcast. But you can't deny that shooting is something that this team has desperately needed for years. And it seems like they have, like, one shooter every team.
Well, it's like Mick has no interest in shooting. I don't understand. Like, I can't fathom how that is. But it really seems like he just doesn't have an interest in shooting. And, you know, like, I don't know how many times in a broadcast we had to hear that Trevor Moore is the best shooter that he's ever recruited. The motherfucker is 6%. 26% this year, and that was an improvement over last year. Like, he's played a lot of basketball. This is what he is. He's not that good a shooter, so I don't give a fuck what he does in practice. Practice doesn't matter. Games matter. He is a terrible shooter. Like, you need to find more shooting somewhere. But he's, like, it's just not something that he values, and that's, it drives me crazy. It really does. I just don't understand it.
Because it doesn't make it, I don't know, it doesn't, like, part of it doesn't make sense. Like Trevor Moore, like, if you just watch him play, it's like his offensive instincts just, like, mostly seem like they're there. And, like, then, like, the biggest issue is, like, he can't shoot. And the teams just leave him wide open. Like, Iowa left him wide open, like, every time. And he shot 26% this season. And he shot, what, 30% last season. So, like, for his career, he's 29% from three. That's like maybe he'll get better. But then, like, you have Keith Williams, who's, like, 27%. And Cam Broome had, like, a really awful year. But, like, his reputation coming in was three-point shooter. Like, he was not afraid to put the ball up at Sacred Heart. And he shot his last year at Sacred Heart, he attempted 200 threes. And he attempted less than that in his 2 years at Cincinnati. So it was, like, somebody who, like, they almost, I don't want to say that he neutered his game, but his game definitely changed. And, like, last year, Broome was, like, a great three-point shooter. Except he only attempted 82 three-pointers all year. And 38 three-pointers in conference play. Which just seems kind of insane, like, looking back on it. That he only attempted 38 three-pointers and they played 16 games. Like, two a game in conference play. But that's neither here nor there. But, like, the big thing is, like, some of these guys some of these guys just, like, it seems like they never get better shooting-wise. Like, the biggest knock on Kevin Johnson was, like, Kevin Johnson was always get left open for three, And he was like never a good three-point shooter. Like, despite how hard he tried, he was a 32% three-point shooter. Troy Copain, like, what, how good a player he was like a 32% three-point shooter his career. And, like, when you have guards that can't shoot, it really hurts your team. When you have to win big games against, like, big teams that take away your superstar.
Yeah, and honestly, like, it's remarkable the offense was as effective as it was this year, given the simple fact that they don't value 3 points as much as two. Like, they are always in the bottom 50 of the country in terms of three-point attempts versus field goal attempts. They're always near the bottom. And like, again, like, if you don't have a great team of shooters, you're not going to shoot a lot of threes. But, like, you got to find the shooters. And, like, this is not a new problem, this mix of three-point attempts to field goal attempts. Like, this has been that way with, like, his entire tenure, with the one exception of that 2012 year when he played four guards and they just jacked shit all the time. That's the only time they've been outside of that bottom 300.
And that, I believe there was one other season. I think it was 2016. Like, those are the only 2 years they've had three guys attempt at least 150 threes. And, like, the 2000, I believe it was, like, 16 season, like, the one other guy was, like, Kevin Johnson. He attempted 150 threes. It was 2017. They had Kevin Johnson, 162, like, Copain, 151, and Jacob Evans, 165. And, like, that was it between that and 2012. And that team won 30 games. Like, what a surprise. Like, I think, yeah, like, one of the biggest, this before you go, Matt, one of the biggest differences in this team is, like, your two highest volume three-point shooters were actually really good from three this year. Because Justin Jennifer's, like, shot out of his ass all year.
Yeah, I mean, like, nobody saw the Jennifer thing coming, and I didn't see Cumberland becoming a 40% three-point shooter with his weird, funky mechanics. Like, I just didn't see how that was going to happen, but here we are. And, you know, they got Samari Curtis coming in, and I really like him as a player, but he's not a shooter. Like, he's a slasher. He's going to attack the rim. Like, he's that kind of player. He's not really a shooter. And I don't know what he shot in high school. And high school shooting often doesn't really translate to college shooting just because it's so much faster. There's really no comparison. But, like, in watching extensive highlights of him on the YouTubes, I don't know if he's going to be an effective three-point shooter at the college rank just because I'm not a huge fan of his release or his footwork. And that's really where it all starts. And, like, if you're not consistent with those two things, it's hard to be a good three-point shooter. I mean, look at Kane Broome this year. Like, he tried four different, like, setups with how he set his feet. He tried a dramatic leg kick. Like, nothing worked. It was just all bad.
Yeah, Curtis is shooting 32.5% from three, which a bit concerning.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's I think he's going to be a really good player, but, like, that's just not a club that he has in his bag. And if he gets it, like, watch out. But I don't foresee that. Like, I don't foresee him being anything more than, like, a 35% three-point shooter here. And that's okay, but that's not – if you're one of two guys that shoots and that's your percentage, that's not great. And, like, that's the thing with UC. Like, there's always just, like, two shooters.
What are some of your thoughts about this, Chris?
I don't know if I can really debate any of what you guys are talking about. I mean, the offense, I mean, statistically is getting better. Like, they revamped it in 2017, and they generated the 34th best offense in the country. They had a month this year where the offense was in the 30s, even times when the offense was rated better than the defense. But, you know, I think UC's heading in the right direction offensively, but I feel like they're holding themselves back with the scheme that they've been running. And we've been, I mean, we're basically beating a dead horse with this, just constantly playing the three and the two. And they're never going to, they can have a top 10 defense. They can have a top 50 offense, which is kind of about probably their wheelhouse right now. Like, we could probably expect that year in and year out, that should get them in the mix, depending on the right draw, depending on the right opponent, to maybe make the second weekend. But they do need to make some tweaks and changes to the offense, and that starts with dumping the 3-2 and playing four guards most of the time. Yeah, I mean, go big if you need to, but unless you're a three-point shooter, unless your bigs can shoot threes like Gary and Kyle Washington were, they're always going to be limited on offense.
Yeah, I mean, like, playing this way with this scheme and this structure, it puts a definite ceiling on what you can do and how effective you can be on offense. Like, you can be an effective offense. Like, 43rd, for the way that they play, for the style that they have, and the lack of movement and, like, ball movement, player movement, any kind of movement, 43rd is remarkable. But, like, 43rd isn't going to get you. It's not going to get you where you want to go. Like, if the goal is to win national titles, you have to be better on offense every year. It can't be a generational, oh, look at this. We somehow assembled this miraculous collection of talent that is awesome once. Like, you have to have a way to generate the kind of productivity that you need year after year, regardless of what your personnel is. It can't be wholly personnel dependent. And with this program, it really is.
Yeah, and I always think that, I mean, I think that this team is going in the right direction. I think it's all about balance. You know, if you can have a top 25 defense, you should have a top 25 offense to complement that. You look at, like, the last five national champions, they were all in the top 10 or top 20 in both categories. The only real exception was UConn in 2014, which I think they had, I'll look it up real quick, they had the
43rd, I think.
At 39th best offense and 10th best defense, which, I mean, they're such a huge outlier. But I kind of want to walk it back a little bit and still see what they do next season. You know, this was still a team in transition. They, in some respects, overachieved against, like, my expectations, depending on who you ask, it'd be, like, right where they were supposed to be. I'd like to see where they're at next year. I think this team should be a top 30 offense. They've shown the capability of doing that within the current system. I don't think that's going to be the what gets them to a national title or gets them to a Final Four or is something that they can sustain long term. I would be curious to see what they do next season offensively. They should be a top 30 offensively if Cumberland returns.
Yeah, and like you mentioned the UConn team. And I'm glad you did because, like, there's a story that I really think is relevant to what we're doing. Like, that UConn team was going nowhere. Like, they were dead in the water for most of that season until roundabout tournament time, Shabazz Napier and Ryan Boatwright flat out took over the offense. They openly ignored any calls that Kevin Ollie made, which, in retrospect, great decision. Kevin Ollie's terrible. He did the right thing. But, like, they ran the show. And so, like, they became the offensive coordinators and Kevin Ollie was the defensive coordinator. Like, and they did everything the way they wanted to do. They executed exactly what they wanted to do all the time. It was their show. Saying that, can you ever envision a situation where a UC player openly overrides Mick Cronin on any play call? Regardless of the effects of the play. Like, can you just envision that happening ever?
Yeah, he'd get anchored to the bench for 20 minutes.
And that brings me to a larger question about this program is, and like, you can have all that other stuff working, you can get better players, you can find a better system, but like, the way that Mick coaches seems to rob guys of their confidence. And it's a much more nebulous thing. Like, there's no data for this, but like, this is just how I feel watching this team. It's like, they are so terrified of making a mistake and disappointing Mick that they can't play. And like that's, you're not going to play effectively in this game like that. It's just not going to happen. And I don't know how you go about changing it, but like, there needs to be some sort of fundamental change in the way this program operates. Because I think like the cycle that we're on, where great regular season, building expectations for the postseason, everybody thinks this is going to be the year, and then they fail in a new way that rhymes exactly with all the other old ways every single year. And, like, I don't know how much longer I can ride that carousel.
Yeah, like, I think, like, the people who are saying, like, Mick should, like, be fired are obviously, like, way off base. But it's, like, the people who are like, oh, Mick should take, like, one of those SEC jobs. That's, like, there's a part of me that, like, wouldn't be that upset if, like, he went to Vanderbilt. She's like, that seems crazy.
Oh, that's mean.
But, like, I don't know. I kind of feel the opposite you do, Chris. I don't really see, like, what optimism you would have for next year based off this year when you lose both your point guards. Like, who's going to run the offense next year? Like, Jaron Berlin, obviously. But it seems like you have a lot more questions next year, and your three best players are all going to be seniors. And you're going to have to really rely on, like, the guys who weren't consistent the whole entire year to be stars. Like, Keith Williams has to be good all year next year. Like, there's, like, that's plain and simple. Like, Trevor Moore has to be good. But you got to think Logan Johnson would start, or at least not start, but actually play minutes. And we didn't really see anything from him offensively this year. Like, so maybe he'll, like, get better over the summer. Like, we just really need to see, like, some of these guys be good the whole entire way. Because, like, what happened to Keith Williams? Like, once teams threw zone at UC consistently, we talked about it a bit last week, he vanished. And, like, he vanished in the tournament game. Like, he scored 4 points and took 5 shots. Like, you cannot have that from one of your starters who plays who plays 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see that side of the coin, especially because we're sort of like going from last season to this season, we're hoping that guys who got a decent amount of minutes but were very inconsistent blossom. And I think, I don't know if Trevor Moore's a lost cause, but two?
I don't think he's a lost cause. No. I don't think he's like a superstar player, though. I'd like to be wrong. But
I don't think UC needs him to be a superstar player, but
they need him to be Matt, good. I don't even know if he can be good.
Well, yeah, that's it. That's my concern, is that it's year two, and Matt, you mentioned something, he's shooting like 20% from three the last 2 years. You know, a guy who's been advertised as a three-point scorer. I don't know if we can necessarily rely on him going forward. Maybe he's just kind of a guy who just happens to be in the mix every now and then, and then you just see a guy like Samari Curtis pass him up. I mean, Keith Williams is a guy who needs to actually develop a jump shot. Among, really, that's his only real major weakness, like glaring weakness about him. I mean, Logan Johnson is a hard one to kind of peg, because I feel like he only came in really on defensive possessions or in times when UC would either up or down by 40 points. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a hopeless optimist. But they've got to be better next year with at least, like, Cumberland, Williams, Brooks, and Scott all coming back. I will say that, like, I'm not in the fire Mick crowd. I think, like, if he left, you know, no matter the circumstances, he's never going to get fired. But if he happened to leave, left for, like, an Old Vandy or Alabama or whatever, I mean, UC should be able to find a new coach. And knowing Mike Bone's track record with, like, Luke Fickell, with Michelle Clark Hurd on the women's basketball side, he's got a decent track record of finding the right coach for this program, and UC should be fine long term. But my issue with the scheme is that even though it's up in the top 50s, it touched the 30s this year. Like we mentioned, it's got a low ceiling, and UC, I think Mick gives a longer leash to some of his players now than he has ever been. But the problem is that if you're playing 3-2, you're just not fast enough back and forth to really generate the type of quick scoring that this team possibly could. And that's kind of my issue with it. Like, if they kept the same offense and they basically just went with 4 guards instead of the 3 guards, the 2 forwards, this would be a top 20 offense every single year.
I'm going to argue with the longer leash point just because the only reason this team won 28 games is because in mid-December, after they lost a couple times, Mick cut his rotation to the bone and played seven dudes the rest of the year. So, like, and there are people in the UC fan base who are like, well, let's, you know, I don't want to fire Mick now, but eventually he'll bottom out. No, this motherfucker will never bottom out. He will do whatever it takes to win 25 games every single year, and he will get him to that point because he's that good of a coach. But, like, this isn't a regular season sport. It really, like, the tournament is all that matters. That's where reputations are made. And like, at the way things are going, Mick is always going to be a coach's coach, a guy that coaches love and who respects. But, like, he's never going to break into the upper echelon of the sport just because he is so dead set on success in that regular season at the detriment of everything else. And like, if anything, the regular season you need to use as a laboratory to expand your bench, to expand the capabilities of your players so that when you get in a situation like we had last Friday where shit is going, you know, shit's hitting the fan and you need to do something different to get a positive result. And, like, for years, UC just hasn't had any other thing they can do. It's like, we have this one way, and if this one way doesn't work, we're totally fucked. And that's going to get you 25 wins a year, and it's going to get to the tournament most years. But you're like Mick is just never going to bottom out. So, like, if we're waiting for that mythical, you know, 10-20 season, it's just never going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone's arguing that, like, this we're hoping for an excuse for Mick to get fired. I don't think he should be fired. I think he's made adjustments over the last couple of years, like completely revamping the offense in 2017. I just think my issue with him is that he on a micro level, within games, he takes too long to make changes. And then on a macro level, he takes too long to make those overarching strategic changes to his offensive and defensive schemes. Like, we talked about this earlier, like 30 minutes ago. How long have they been running the matchup zone and gotten torched from the three-point line? Like, half a decade? Like, why aren't we making adjustments to counter that glaring weakness on the defense? But it's something that he just accepts and just kind of lives with and has killed him in the NCAA tournament. And that's kind of my biggest issue with Mick, is that he takes too long to make wide, overarching changes.
I mean, like, I don't think Mick's a great in-game coach. I just don't. I think he's a great program builder. I think what he does in terms of building a culture is incredibly impressive. But, like, culture only gets you so far. Like, you have to have that piece to succeed. You really do. That is something that you have to have. But you also have to have that in-game tactical know-how and flexibility. And that's where Mick is lacking. And I don't know if it's a staff shakeup that needs to happen so that he can get somebody in here that has that capability, because it's just not – this program as currently run just doesn't have that ability. And I don't know if the blame for that goes squarely at the feet of Mick or if it goes at the feet of his assistants, but that is something that has been missing for a very long time.
Well, I think the issue I have with bringing in an assistant is that, you know, how much leash is he going to have? He's always going to be working under the umbrella of a Mick Cronin program, unless Mick absolutely goes out there, you know, has a come to Jesus moment and says, "Hey, I got to do a lot of things differently. Let's bring in someone from Villanova or hell, I don't know, like Iowa for an example, someone who can create different things schematically than we've had in the program for years." No matter what the hell happens to UC on defense, I don't think a staff changeup is going to do anything, unfortunately.
Well, if, like, you're going to change your staff, then, like, nothing's going to change. Like, you're still going to end up with an offense in the 40s and, like, a defense, like, in the at least the top 30s and hopefully top 20s, hopefully, like, top 10. Like, you'd just be running the same cycle. Like, that seems like the really only, the only coaching shakeup we saw was Larry Davis got, like, knocked out, and they just promoted somebody from, like, the staff anyway. Like, they didn't really make any big moves that when they could have last year. So in that sense, like, I agree with you, Chris. I don't think they're going to change the coaching staff, but I think something like that is definitely needed, because we keep hearing how everything's going to change, and then, like, nothing changes. Like, what? Like, they just end up with some better guards, that, like, in guys who can shoot, and, like, pretty much things just go the same way, like, the last, like, 7 years, and you're sitting at home, like, as the Sweet 16 rolls around. I mean, this year they were eating dinner in Cincinnati after playing in Columbus.
Yeah, I mean, and part of it might be, you know, to play devil's advocate there, maybe part of it is just they just don't have the resources for a good offensive assistant or a good outside assistant, no matter, you know, what side of the ball they tend to have more mastery over. I mean,
case, then it's a gigantic program issue. Where your university's not putting money into the basketball program. And, like, that seems like it would be something that would make Mick Cronin want to look elsewhere.
Well, I mean, it took them, what, over 10 years to renovate a badly needed basketball arena? And, you know, Mick had to raise money for the locker rooms himself.
that's a good
point.
And
he flirted with UNLV, so maybe there is something to that.
Maybe there is.
I mean, like, this coaching staff, the last time there was a major defection from the coaching staff was when Tony Stubblefield left the Bearcats to go to Oregon. That was in 2010. This group has been intact since then.
Well, that's kind of my question is, the longer you're on a coaching staff, you're always going to see incremental raises. Like, maybe guys like Antoine Jackson or Darren Savino are just making so much money on that staff that Mick doesn't have room to hire in someone else of good quality. I don't know. I'm just spitballing there.
Well, I don't think like that. I take your point on that, but my biggest issue is like there's been no new ideas in that room in a decade. Like it's been the same guys, and like that is a great recipe for stagnation. And I would argue that is what this program has done. It is stagnated. It has gotten to a good level, and like I'm happy with where it is. I'm the amount of success that they've had over the last 5 years has been phenomenal, but there's no denying that this is a plateau. Like they've gotten to this level and they've stayed at this level for a long time, and that's hard to do to get to that level and to maintain it. But are they ever going to take the next step?
Yeah, this is definitely basketball first world program or first world problems. Wow. Like when you're pissed off because your team keeps making the tournament and doesn't go further, and like, but like to that point, like I think that's really interesting.
Well, no, like I don't think that's the first world. Like Mick has set the expectation. Mick has said, "I want to win national titles," and what you're doing is not going to get you to there. So do other stuff, like change it up, do something different, make adjustments.
That's very true and very fair. I was going to say on the coaching stuff, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting is you never really hear any of these guys like mentioned for other jobs, which I think Savino's like a good coach, and like the other guys seem like they're nice people. Like it is kind of interesting, like despite the success, like nobody's like interested. Like, being, like, tossed out there to go, like, some max school.
Well, like, what was the last one? It was, like, Larry Davis and, like, Montana State or something like that?
Yeah. Which was a great move for Montana State.
Apparently. Yeah, it's a little telling, and I don't know. I mean, there's something to that coaches just want to coach. Like, that. There's a difference between being an assistant coach and working, you know, 100% within the game and being a head coach and kind of being, you know, playing a little bit politician, a little bit representative of the program, a little bit, you know, manager or CEO or whatever, and just being a coach. So maybe there's something to that, but it also is interesting that, like you mentioned, Matt, I think you said 2010 was the last time another program took a coach from UC.
Yeah, it was Tony Stubblefield. He went to Oregon, and not to say that like the success of Oregon is all Tony Stubblefield, but like they've had a remarkable run in the time since. If you have a group at your job where you have a specific thing you're supposed to do, and you have the same people who have been doing the same thing forever, are you ever going to get new ideas from that group? No, you need to. You need new ideas. You need new people in there. And yeah, I really think somebody from the outside with a different perspective on how basketball is played would do this staff a world of good. And whether or not that's actually going to happen, I don't know. I'd probably say no. If I'm a betting man, I bet no. But I would like to see what would happen. I'd like to see it. Like, you know, I don't have much money, but I'll give you $10 for it, UC. Please. Put my $10 towards another assistant for basketball.
Just looking at, like, the overall stats, it's like the biggest difference they made is they got to the free throw line. Got a ton this year and stopped turning the ball over. Because that doesn't really seem like it's a program change. That just seems like it was, like, Jerron Cumberland was really good at going to the free throw line. I know Bearcat Journal guys have been, like, talking a lot about how UC needs to step up their recruiting. Like, do you think that's something that we're going to see, or do you think that they're really kind of locked into, like, these three-star level guys? It's like in Mick Cronin's history, like, they have this the all-time recruits. He's put in 2 5-stars, Lane Stephenson, we mentioned, Jermaine Lawrence, Chris mentioned earlier. Like, in, they both lasted 1 year, and Jermaine Lawrence was, who knows, like, what happened with him just in his career in general. He only played 2 seasons. Like, then, like, you have Yancey Gates, that's a 4-star, then that Cumberland, also a 4-star, and then so on. But, like, they haven't really had consistent 4-star guys since, like, Mick's really early classes. That was Biggie McLean, Cash, Darnell Wilkes, like, on the line like that. It's like, do you think something like that should be happening more here? Or do you think we're kind of just stuck in this cycle where, like, they're looking for, like, more, like, the project guys and off-the-beaten-path guys?
There is a reason with a program of UC stature, UC's history, the brand-new arena, the players' facility, all this stuff. There's no reason a program like this cannot consistently land. You know, you're probably not going to get top 25 guys, but you should be able to get the guys 25 to 75. You should have 2-3 of those in every class. There's no reason that that does not happen other than choices that are being made. And like, I really think the Lance Stephenson experience was illustrative for Mick, because I think he tried it. He didn't like it. He tried it again with Jermaine Lawrence. He really didn't like that. And, like, ever since then, like, they don't even swim in that pool. Not really. Like, when was the last time they were really in on a kid of that stature that they missed on? I can't recall one. Maybe Tandy this year, but that's kind of a stretch. Like, he didn't seem to be mentioning UC at all towards the end of his process.
I mean, they went after Lawrence this year, who ultimately landed at Marquette. They're going after CJ Wilcher, who they're in the top 10 on. I agree, Matt. I think with the new arena, with the proven success of getting players into the NCAA tournament, all of that should elevate the program from recruiting-wise. Like, I think that I'm fine with Mick going after a project here or there, but the problem I have is when you have an entire class full of guys like Prince Gillum or LeHartnett, guys you never heard of or who have very few offers up until, you know, UC ends up offering him, or like Ilyil Sosume. All decent players, but those aren't players that you can really use and elevate the program. If you need a guy like Jerron Cumberland, who can come in and get freshman minutes, and maybe he doesn't score 10 points a game, but he's getting decent minutes, and he's contributing to the offense and defense. Like, getting a guy like Samir Torrance or CJ Wilcher are those types of prospects, and that should be the bulk of your recruiting classes going forward. And, I mean, that's my biggest thing, one of my biggest things, more than just, like, what this team does from a philosophical standpoint, offensively or defensively. Can you start going after those prospects that, you know, your peers are going after? Not necessarily like the Dukes or the North Carolinas, but you're not losing prospects to like Marquette or or Pittsburgh or Indiana or Xavier or whatever. Like you have a brand new sparkling arena. You have fans packed in it every single night. You have money flowing into the program. You have new everything. The conference as a whole is seen far better than it was 3 or 4 years ago. You should be landing prospects that should be able to play within the first 2 or 3 years, or in the first 1 or 2 years. Not projects, like actual players who are ready to play at the collegiate level right out of the gate.
Well, and then here's the flip side of this. If they had better talent, the structural deficiencies with how they play don't matter as much. And we know this because last year it didn't matter as much. And you know what? They had a fuck ton of talent. Talent masks a lot of things. But they just don't have it flowing in at the rate they needed to make this scheme work to the level that Mick wants it to work. To the level that we all want it to work. We want this team to win national titles. They have the resources. They have the capability. You know, you don't need to have, like, college was one sport where you don't really need to have Alabama-level resources to win at a big level. Like, you can win at a big level with Butler resources, because Butler did it. Like, there's no reason they can't do that here, but, like, the talent level that they have been bringing in the last couple classes is just not good enough.
Yeah, and, I mean, you're looking at, like, a team, like, down the road at Memphis. Like, you know, granted, the number one overall player isn't just going to come walking through UC's doors. And granted, Weissman was coached by Penny Hardaway in high school. But Memphis is out-recruiting UC right now. UConn is out-recruiting UC right now. Houston's out-recruiting UC.
Everybody's right out-recruiting UC.
Like, I mean, that's the thing. If you want it, like, I'm not saying go shady, you know, start throwing bags of money around, but you've got to do something a little different. And I think one of the criticisms with Torrance was that, you know, he signed with Marquette because he could get early playing time. You know, why can't you convince him that, you know, hey, I'll, you know, because of you, I'll, you know, run more 4-on-1 guard scheme so you can see the floor a lot more as a true freshman.
Hey, Samir, you know, have you looked at our 2-deep?
I know.
Who's coming back? Have some confidence, my man. Like, Jesus.
My concern is that overall the conference as a whole is getting better, and UC's taken advantage to a degree of an AAC conference where they're a top dog, and you know that's how they came into the conference. That's how it's been for a little while. But if Memphis and UConn and Houston continue to recruit the way they're doing now, even like UCF to a degree, my fear is that UC's just going to kind of get into the mix near the end of in a year or two. And it's going to become harder and harder and harder to compete for conference titles, which it's fine, but UC should be winning titles in this conference like once out of every 3 years.
And like the Grinder recruiting scheme, like just like going back to 2010, they've had three classes around the top 30. It was 2013, 14, and 2011. It's like they pulled this off like rather recently. And those 2013, 2014 classes were the basis of the major rise the last couple of years. Like, those were the classes that had, like, Copain, Kevin Johnson, like, also Jermaine Lawrence, and Mormon, and Jeremy Strickland. Like, guys who didn't work out. Like, overall, class very highly rated. But Gary Clark, Quad Moore, DeBerry, Farad Cobb, Octavius Ellis class. And like in 2011 class, it was like Shaq Thomas, Sanders, the original Octavius Ellis, Gwynn, and Jeremiah Davis, and Moosh. Like, so, like, he's, like, proven he can find, like, better guys, like, at least, like, recruiting ranking-wise. And, like, guys who have, like, played a huge part of the system. Like, I don't really understand, like, why they've had a bit of, like, a drop-off when they've been able to, like, get more, like, the higher profile bigs who he's given minutes to. It's not like these guys never played. It's like DeBerry played and like Quad played for better or worse, and like Gary Clark played from like minute one. So it is kind of odd. And then like on your point about like the league, it's getting harder. It's gonna be harder to win now. And like now that Tulane like is probably gonna stop being a dumpster fire. At least, like, they hired, like, a coach who's actually a good coach in Ron Hunter. Like, you got to think that program's going to stop being garbage. Like, and then, like, you like look to some of the other ones. Like, Temple, who knows how good Aaron McKee's going to be. Like, Tulsa's probably always going to be decent just because of all the JUCOs they bring in. And, like, Frank Haith isn't a bad coach. And, like, East Carolina, like, just really bad. But, like, their recruiting class ranks better than Cincinnati's right now because UC only has one player and they have three. So it's going to be just really interesting to see, like, where they go, because you didn't mention Wichita State, like, in the team who was one of the hottest hottest in the conference to close the year. Like, next year is going to be really competitive, like, probably just like this year was. So, it'd be, I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see, like, what happens if, like, you end up not meeting expectations next year. And, like, not meeting expectations for this program is, like, finishing third or fourth in the league. The regular season.
Yeah, Memphis, UConn, Wichita State all have top 50 recruiting classes coming in. Like, the talent level is better. And Memphis and UConn are top 20. And like, this league isn't going to get any easier. Like, we took great advantage of a down period for UConn and Memphis. And those are at an end. Like, there are going to be on the uptick. And, like, it's not going to be as easy as it has been for the last couple of years, because this conference is getting remarkably better.
And if, like, Kelvin Sampson doesn't leave, you got to think Houston is at least going to be staying, like, the trajectory they're on. It's like they do lose, like, Corey Davis and, like, Brady and just, well, I think somebody else important. But, like, they bring almost everybody else back, and, like, they have just, like, a really good team and, like, a really good system. And, like, they should be able to bring in guys who can shoot in the offseason as well.
Yeah, guys, I got to drop off here, but, yeah, I totally agree. It's one of the situations of keeping up with the Joneses. And, I mean, UC's poured money into the program to, you know, on the surface, make it look like a Power 5, whatever you want to call it, kind of program. And you know, we've got to see changes where on the floor and on the recruiting trail, they see they do the same thing. So, I don't know. I would hope my expectations is that with the arena, with all the good things happening there, with all the good things happening in the program, we see more quality recruits coming through and less projects that take three and a half years to pan out or don't pan out at all. But my fear is that we're just going to kind of keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we're going to be banging our heads against the wall here next March.
Yeah, that seemed like a pretty good place to wrap it up. Do you have any final thoughts, Matt?
I really hope we're not on the treadmill of mediocrity, but I kind of fear we are.
Like, my biggest worry is, like, the program is stagnated, as, like, you said earlier. But, like, I really hope I'm not right. Like, I feel the same way as you do. Well, thanks for joining us, and we'll be back next week or the week after, hopefully with a more positive podcast. But thanks for joining us, and as always, go Bearcats!